Hello, this is Mary Moulton reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, June 25th, 2026. On the front page of the News Gazette is a series of photos with the headline Fielding Ideas from the Oakwood School District. And the article is Public Hearing to Discuss Possible Bond Sale for Athletic Facility Proposal. Tim Lee has seen more Oakwood High School sporting events than most in Vermilion County, and the Comet's outdoor athletic facilities didn't change much from the time he graduated from Oakwood in 1983 to when he concluded an 8-year stint as principal at his alma mater in 2021. We've really been on the same athletic field since, I suppose, for football. It's been that way since the 40s or 50s. Whenever that field got realigned or laid out where it was, Lee said, baseball has been since the 70s. With several area school districts continuing to renovate and add to their state-of-the-art athletic facilities, Oakwood Community Unit School District 76 also is looking to jump on board and add a new complex. A public hearing will be held at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday at the district office in Oakwood to receive public comments on a proposal to sell bonds in an amount not to exceed $9 million to pay claims against the district for such an athletic project. Excuse me. Which would include new baseball, softball, track, and football facilities, as well as a track and concession stand that would have bathrooms and locker rooms. A school board meeting was postponed due to weather earlier this month. I think it's going to be a big boost to the community having some state-of-the-art facilities, Oakwood High Athletic Director Richard Vitter said. The plan is to be used for the junior high and the high school, and then hopefully it'll permit other community organizations to be able to use that. According to Superintendent Andy Jordan, one of the purposes for which the district is authorized to issue bonds is to pay claims against the district, generally referred to as funding bonds. The claims that can be paid with this bond issue include the district's debt certificates. The district issued debt certificates to fund the district's athletic field project. Sorry, I have a dry throat this morning. We are looking to do a 10-year repayment plan for the bond, Jordan said. The 10 years would allow us to keep the tax rate the same without having to increase the tax rate to the taxpayers moving forward. If we went with a shorter period, we would have to increase the levy, and we don't have any interest in doing that. Jordan added that the district currently doesn't have a track, baseball field, or softball field for its student-athletes. Its baseball and softball teams currently play at Oakwood City Park. While Lee recalled that John Davis, a 9-time IHSA state champion in cross-country and track, never ran a home meet before competing in Illinois. Honestly, the biggest thing that is going to help us with this ability to practice on a regular basis on our field, Oakwood baseball coach Ryan McFarland said. The early practice when you're trying to get these reps and sometimes you get some bad weather, to be able to get out balls out there for even just 30 minutes, taking ground balls, fly balls, letting your pitchers work on stuff, I think it will make a big difference. Vetter completed his first year as Oakwood's athletic director in May and has already been taking plenty of public feedback into consideration. Much of the feedback he's heard has been positive. Some of it has been really, really helpful, Vetter said. Obviously, the public is a huge piece in this, and we've gotten a lot of good positive support from this, and we're hoping to continue to build in those next few months before the shovels go under the ground. Lee, whose son Cameron now coaches Oakwood's football team, has also heard plenty of talk about new facilities over the years. He was involved when trying to bring upgrades to Oakwood's various venues various times throughout the 33 years in education. I remember we started on committees in the 90s, Lee said, so there have been plenty of superintendents and administrators and community members and coaches and staff members that have put time and effort into this. I know it's been a long process, but I feel like we're on the right track, and hopefully we will get ground broken and we begin to see some facilities out there for our kids. Other Vermilion County schools have renovated their athletic facilities in recent years, including Bismarck, Henning, Rossville, Alvin, Danville, Georgetown, Rich Farm, Salt Fork, and Westville. If you look at it, almost all of them have improved something or most of their stuff within the last probably 5 years, McFarland said. Even if they haven't gone to turf, they've improved their surfaces, they've improved their drainage, they've improved their lighting. They've all consistently worked to make their facilities better. To Jordan's knowledge, the district has been looking into the athletic field project since 2022. The location would be on school district property next to the Oakwood City Park, about 2 blocks away from the K-8 building. Oakwood's junior high teams would also be able to capitalize on the new fields. Our junior high baseball team actually practices at Oakwood City Park, but we have to go to Tilton to play because there just isn't the space there to allow both those programs to go on at the same time, McFarland said. So it benefits our high school program a lot, but it's also going to benefit our junior high program. The school board likely will not sign an agreement for the full athletic field project until financing is in place, though optimism abounds that shovels will be in the ground this fall. If everything falls into place, our best case scenario would be to have football playing in the fall of 2027, Jordan said. This is an exciting project for the district to be able to improve the facilities comparable to what other neighboring schools have already done. University of Illinois System. Turnout strong for presidential search sessions. 3 cities, 3 days, roughly 300 miles on the road. The University of Illinois Presidential Search Committee and the firm AGB Search recently wrapped up a whirlwind tour of town halls, Chicago on June 16th, Springfield on June 17th, and Urbana-Champaign on June 18th, in an effort to hear what constituents at all three campus communities want in a new system president. There was a lot of driving around, joked Ramjan Cepeda, who is a member of the Board of Trustees and co-chair of the search committee. About 292 miles worth, according to Google Maps. Search committee co-chair Ann Jung, who is a professor of music and strings area chair of the Champaign-Urbana campus, said that the sessions were very productive, with more than 100 stakeholders participating. The participation spread nearly equally across the 3 sessions, she said, at the search committee's Wednesday meeting. We heard many different viewpoints and gathered valuable input for the development of the leadership profile that will describe the kind of leader we are seeking. The committee moved into an executive session following Young's brief update. The U of I System's Presidential Search Committee is composed of U of I faculty, students, staff, administrators, and alumni. Some members convene in Chicago for Wednesday's meeting, while others video conference in from the Champaign-Urbana campus. U of I System President Tim Colleen announced in January 2026 that he plans to step down when his contract ends on June 30, 2027. He has served in this role since 2015. An estimated search timeline from U of I officials designates May and June as a time to focus on listening to input as well as developing a leadership profile and perspective. The system expects to finalize the prospectus and begin an active search around July or August. Officials previously said that the committee is likely to begin officially accepting nominations in mid-July and expects to do so through early September. While the search committee and AGB are assisting with the search process, including screening and identifying candidates, the Board of Trustees will ultimately be responsible for selecting the next system president. More information about the presidential search, along with a link to provide input anonymously via a survey, can be found at illinois.edu/about/presidential_search. Input can also be provided by emailing uisystempresidentsearch@illinois.edu. Champaign County Courts, Urbana man convicted of sex assault of a minor. An Urbana man was handcuffed as he was led from the courtroom Wednesday after being convicted of sexually assaulting a victim under the age of 13. Stephen Thompson, 25, had been out of jail on pretrial release as he awaited the resolution of his case. A Champaign County jury deliberated for around 2 hours and 45 minutes before returning the guilty verdict. while his attorney, Aaron Weiner, pointed out that Thompson has consistently appeared and doesn't have a previous criminal record. Assistant State's attorneys, N.G. Lin and Joel Fletcher, argued that he now has a motivation to flee and the crime he was convicted of implies potential harm to the public. Lin said that in addition to the victim who testified at the trial, other family members had come forth with allegations about Thompson. None of them agreed to testify, she said, to those claims could not be used as evidence, but she believed that they were worth considering in weighing whether Thompson should be detained until his next court date. The next date is scheduled for September when Champaign County Judge Roger Weber will hear post-trial motions and, depending on how those are resolved, possibly move ahead with Thompson's sentence. Thompson took the stand Wednesday, the second day of his trial, to share his testimony regarding allegations that he had assaulted a female relative on multiple occasions. The victim, who testified Tuesday that she remembered Thompson sitting down next to her on the couch while she was watching TV at 4 years old and touching her legs and private parts. She also detailed similar incidents she said happened in a vehicle in the summer of 2022 when she was around 10 years old. While the victim couldn't recall certain details like the clothes Thompson was wearing, she was able to recount more about those incidents than the earlier one. Both on the stand and in a previous interview at a children's advocacy center in Texas, where her family moved, the victim described how the incident progressed and certain sense memories that Fletcher highlighted in his closing arguments. Thompson testified that parts of her account of the summer were incorrect and that he was rarely seeing family members, including the victim, outside of church when she was younger. He told Lynn that the sides of the family didn't have any dispute, nor did he have any with the victim, before this case came to light. The victim did not initially tell anyone that something happened, and no adult learned about the allegations until her cousin overheard her telling her sister about it and eventually shared with his own mother. This meant that there was no relevant physical evidence for either side when it came to trial, leaving the jury to deliberate over which witnesses they believed. The state's argument focused on how the victim was able to remember and describe things like Thompson's breathing getting heavier and the way he touched her, implying an experience that children her age would not be familiar with. Additionally, there was no motive discovered for her to have invented the story. The defense's argument focused around discrepancies from one account to the next, calling the allegations entirely false and saying that lives would be destroyed if the jury convicted based on those supposedly false allegations. Thompson faces between 6 and 60 years in prison. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. News notes from the newsroom. Thanks to longtime News Gazette journalists Tom Kasich, Marcus Jackson, Mary Schenck, and John Dixon for co-hosting this week's News Gazette Radio on WDWS and WSOY. It was a treat to hear from them and the many sources and friends who called in to roast and toast them. Podcasts of each show, powered by GTPS Insurance, are available at newsgazette.com. As year 29 of CU Kiwanis Tom Jones Challenger League winds down, we'll join the determined kids for Saturday's picnic day at Urbana's Ambucks Park. With 10 teams, the league that gives children facing physical and mental challenges the opportunity to play baseball continues to grow. We'll have coverage from Saturday as well as the All-Star Games on July 14th at Eichelberger Field. Interested in helping out? Email tjclvolunteer@gmail.com. Voice of the Illini, Brian Barnhart, has a good reason to miss Monday's Penny for Your Thoughts on WDWS. He'll be in Greensboro, North Carolina to accept his award as 2025 Illinois Sportscaster of the Year, presented by the National Sports Media Association. He also won in 2008. People's Choice voting ends at 11:59 p.m. Friday. We'll celebrate our many winners on September 9th at Riggs Beer Company in Urbana. Teacher of the Week, Morgan Wilson, 5th grade, Fisher Grade School. Keeping on topic. In her third year teaching with grade fifth grade at Fisher Grade School, Morgan Wilson is known for her ability to make learning fun and engaging, even with more challenging topics. I find my work important because I get to be part of helping students learn and grow, not only as students, but as individuals outside of the classroom. I became a teacher because I love building relationships with kids. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is dissecting owl pellets and then building skeletons with the bones we find. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when students see for themselves the potential I have always seen in them. I keep students engaged by taking time to laugh together. Something else I'm passionate about is spending time with my husband and two children. My favorite teacher was my fifth grade teacher, Carrie Calcagno, at Lincoln Trail Elementary in Mahomet. My favorite subject to study in school was social studies. If I weren't a teacher, I would be working with pre-service teachers at the university level. I'm spending my summer traveling with my family, running lots, and reading for enjoyment. A legacy brand sunset. Illinois radio stations reckon with CBS News Radio's shutdown. When Gary Scott, general manager of WLDS-WEAI, opened the letter informing him that CBS News Radio would shut down after decades providing programming for his Jacksonville radio station, he was stunned. "My jaw literally hit the desk when I read it," Scott said. "It was clearly stated that I had to read it two or three times before it finally sank in." Scott said he received the letter in the mail two or three months before officials pulled the plug. He shared the news with the station's co-owner, who was equally shocked and confused about where their decision had come from. WLDS-WEAI has long been a major trusted source of news, farm, and sports coverage for Morgan, Scott, Green, and Cass counties in west central Illinois. "We were very much blindsided by it, and I had this sickening feeling that we have lost something in this country," Scott said. CBS News Radio went silent May 22nd, citing economic hardships, another in a string of bumpy and very public business decisions for the broadcast network. The shutdown ended nearly a century of national and global radio news that brought historic events into America's living room. From Edward R. Murrow's London Blitz broadcast to coverage of Pearl Harbor and the Cuban Missile Crisis. As longtime CBS affiliate stations across the state moved to other news services, broadcasters and industry professionals are weighing how the loss will impact local coverage and what it signals about the future of radio news. Stations adopt new partners. In Chicago, WBBM News Radio was among the Odyssey stations left searching for a replacement after CBS News Radio announced it would end its services. As late as April, it was unclear what would fill the gap until the station switched to ABC News Radio one day before CBS News Radio went silent, according to the Chicago Tribune. For some downstate Illinois stations, however, the switch came seamlessly. Tammy Songaroth, general manager of NRG Media Ottawa, which operates WCMI, said the station moved to NBC News Radio almost immediately after learning of the closure. "It was a very fast decision," Songaroth said. "We wanted to get everybody acclimated before everybody had to switch, because why wait?" She added that the adjustment was relatively easy because NRG Media Ottawa was already paying for NBC News as part of another program the company uses. Scott Miller, morning show host at WJBC in the Bloomington Normal region, said the station experienced a similarly smooth shift, though it moved to ABC News Radio instead. Miller said ABC News Radio was able to replace much of the programming lost with the end of the CBS News Radio, including top-of-the-hour news, weekend programming, and short segments on entertainment and financial news. He added that WJBC listeners are unlikely to notice much of a difference. "There's just sadness to see a legacy brand sunset like this, but we looked at our options that were available to get a national news service, and ABC seemed to be the obvious choice for us," Miller said. "Difficult to sell to our listeners." But for Scott, the next step for WLDS-WEAI was not as clear. "CBS has always been at the top of the list," he said. "It was a network that I always wanted to be a part of because I think it's so well respected, and I just thought it was the top of the game. Everything else was a distant second, so it hasn't been easy for us to adjust." Well, Scott ultimately settled on NBC News Radio. He said the transition required him to revamp key aspects of his station's coverage. NBC did not offer direct replacements for several CBS News Radio programs WLDS WEAI had relied on, including some newscasts and weekend programming like Face the Nation and Eye on Travel. He said those changes are already apparent in WLDS WEAI listeners, with the station receiving a few complaints about adjustments to programming that listeners had grown accustomed to over the decades. It was difficult to sell the change to our listeners, but I think they understand that it was not our decision to drop CBS. It was CBS's decision to drop us, Scott said. For Scott, the loss has prompted broader questions about how radio news is valued by today's audiences. He warned that the continued decline of traditional news could contribute to the spread of bias and misinformation through other media sources, from digital and cable outlets to social media platforms. It's a step away from what really should be news. Newspapers, TV, and radio, whether it's local or national, he said, we're getting much less of that these days, and it can't do anything but hurt us in the long run. I fear for this country because of this loss. For Scott Station and other local radio stations in rural or less populous areas, the local radio station is often a community institution and may be one of the last remaining sources of local news as the industry continues to contract nationally. Its value proposition is rooted in common interests, shared connections with its audiences, and a history that spans generations of listeners. WLDS has been on the air since a few days after the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. It became an affiliate of the Chicago Cubs in 2018 and Chicago Bears in 2019. A message on its website states, WEAI became an affiliate of the St. Louis Cardinals in the 1960s. Familiar pressure for industry. Illinois Broadcasters Association Chair and Morgan County Media General Manager Sarah Shellhammer said the shutdown of CBS News Radio reflects broader pressures facing the broadcast industry as news organizations compete with newer ways of reaching consumers. She said listeners are tuning in to different sources for news, a shift that broadcasters have had to take into consideration. Radio has had to adjust to streaming and the internet and a lot of the other options people have to gain news and information, Shellhammer said. People are consuming news and media differently than they did 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, or even 20 years ago. Shellhammer added that the end of CBS News Radio did not have as great an impact as it would have 50 years ago, as other news sources have emerged over the decades and fewer stations have relied on its content. But not everyone sees those shifts as a sign that traditional radio is nearing its end. Miller said radio has faced predictions of decline before, from concerns that car radios would distract drivers to worries that satellite radio would mean the death of traditional radio. Each time, he said, the industry found ways to adapt. Satellite radio is still here, and traditional radio is still here, Miller said. Has it changed? Has it evolved? Yes, but so has the microwave, and so has the lawnmower. If you're not evolving, then what are you doing? The radio is evolving and keeping up with the other media that's out there. Camp Mystic, site of flood deaths, files for bankruptcy. Dallas. Camp Mystic filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization Wednesday, nearly a year after catastrophic floods killed 25 campers and two teenage counselors at the Christian Camp for Girls along the Guadalupe River in Texas. Camp Mystic has been under increasing pressure since the July 4th disaster. Owners had planned to reopen the Texas Hill Country Camp this summer for its 100th anniversary, but reversed course in April amid outrage from victims' families and lawmakers. Families filed lawsuits accusing the camp of failing to protect the girls as the powerful floodwaters approached. Camp Mystic's owner, Richard Eastland, also died in the flood. The camp listed its debt at more than $10 million, according to the filing made in federal bankruptcy court in Houston. An attorney for Camp Mystic has not responded to an email and a phone message seeking comment. Bankruptcy will not stop all reasonable parties from being held accountable. Paul Yetter, a lawyer who represents multiple families of campers and counselors who died at the camp, said in a statement, "These innocent girls deserve justice." For decades, Camp Mystic was a summer staple and an institution for generations of families who dropped off their girls at the sleepaway camp to ride horses, canoe, fish, and attend Bible studies. Other summer camps in Kerr County, west of Austin, did not take on such devastating flooding and in some cases have reopened. All told, the destructive flooding killed at least 136 people along a several-mile stretch of the river, raising questions about how things went so terribly wrong. In the aftermath of the tragedy, the Easton family spent months determined to reopen the camp this summer, pointing to enhanced safety measures that included flood-warning river monitors and putting two-way radios enabled with national weather alerts in every cabin. By the spring, Camp Mystic's attorney said it was ready to reopen for business for nearly 900 campers. But assurances of safety did not convince victims' families and some Texas lawmakers. State regulators found nearly two dozen deficiencies in the emergency operations plan submitted by the owners, including in proposals for flood warning evacuations and safety training. General in charge of European African theaters suddenly resigns. The Army's commander of its forces in Europe and Africa, who was famously the last American soldier to leave Afghanistan in 2021, is unexpectedly stepping down from his post after just 18 months in the job, the Army confirmed late Tuesday. General Christopher Donahue, commanding general of U.S. Army Europe and Africa's and commander of NATO's Allied Land Command, will relinquish his command July 2nd, according to an Army statement provided to the Associated Press. He is the latest in a line of nearly two dozen top military leaders to either retire or depart their jobs early under the leadership of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who has undertaken an effort to thin the ranks of the military's top brass with the mantra, "Less generals, more GIs." Donahue's Deputy Major General Christopher Norrie will perform his duties in the meantime, the statement said. A West Point graduate and a career Special Operations Commander, Donahue commanded Delta Force units in Iraq and Afghanistan, having before leading the 82nd Airborne Division from July 2020 to March 2022. It was during that period that he was brought in to restore security at Hamid Karzai International Airport during the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from the country in 2021. On August 30, 2021, Donahue became the last U.S. soldier to depart the country after nearly 20 years of war sparked by the attacks of September 11, 2001. The moment was documented in an iconic photo taken through night vision goggles that showed the general boarding the last C-17 cargo plane to depart the country. Hegseth and President Donald Trump had made the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, an operation that was set in motion by a treaty negotiating with the Taliban by the first Trump administration, a regular political punching bag and the subject of new Pentagon review. Last May, Hegseth ordered the new examination of the withdrawal, despite there having already been multiple reviews of the operation by the Pentagon, U.S. Central Command, the State Department, and Congress, which have involved hundreds of interviews and studies of videos, photographs, and other footage and data. It's unclear what specific new information the new interview is seeking. The Donahue's leadership during the evacuation had nonetheless drawn bipartisan praise. Within the Army, he was widely seen as a top officer who could have led the service or been chosen to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, June 25th, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.